Okay, well, let's just go ahead and get started. And thanks for those of you that are on the call and those of you that are listening via the podcast or on YouTube. We did a lot of conversations back and forth as we tried to figure out what do we want to talk about for passage planning. And we came up with the list kept getting bigger and bigger, and we just added the last little bits about an hour ago to the talk today. Okay, so for this call and for this conversation, we have four different people, four different boats that are represented to just talk about their experiences as we relate to passage planning as we're getting ready to do the big offshore passage. And what I'd like to do is kind of go round robin and start with Glenn. And just Glenn, just give an update where you're located, and just also if you can just summarize some of your offshore sailing experiences and what you've logged, if you have any idea on how in the nautical miles offshore, so people have some idea of just kind of what you've done. So Glenn, we'll start with you.
Sure. So Glenn McGonigal, the 2017 Mira catamaran, and we've crossed over about 31,000 miles total on Mira. The majority of the, I would say, the longer passages contribute to that. So we've done two Atlantic passages to the Mediterranean and back, and we did the Caribbean 1500, rallied down Hampton to the Caribbean, and then of course we did the passages up to the Caribbean on our original delivery, and a few long ones offshore on the Pacific side of Central America.
Okay, great. Thanks, Glenn. Sarah and Steven, you guys are actually underway. So, what's going on?
We are on our way back to the US from the Bahamas. We have been on our boat 1 year and have just passed the 10,000 mile marker.
That's awesome.
Congratulations. Yeah, congratulations. Scott and Barbara, you guys are, what's going on?
Where are you?
We're freshies. I did a test passage from St. Martin to Bermuda up to Newport a few years ago on a big swan. I don't know how many miles that was. And then we've just gotten to Grenada a couple weeks ago from Brazil,
Or from Buenos
or
Aires.
from BA. Did the first leg up to Angra
With Scott and Monica.
with Scott and Monica, and then played around in Brazil. And then the last leg of the passage was Cabedelo up to Grenada.
Very good. Well, welcome. Thanks. I'm Mark, and I'm on field trip. We have about 55,000 miles on our boat. A lot of it has been in the South Pacific and up and down in the Caribbean. We also did the passage from Argentina all the way up. So, we've had a good time. Let's just say that. So I can't believe it's been so long. And so let's get started. So the format for the roundtable, just to keep people in the loop on this, if this is your first time attending, and that's just we just ask that you raise your hand, or you can actually ask a question in the chat as we're going through the different topics. At the very end, we'll have an open Q&A session, so that's also wide open for any sort of questions people may have. Just a fun tidbit, all of the images in here I just used AI to generate. So any image that you see in here is actually done through AI. I was kind of doing some messing around with it basically, and you'll see some interesting images, but they're all from AI. Okay,
Very cool.
so let's jump into the topics that we're going to be covering, and we kept adding them as I mentioned. So we're going to first just talk in general about passage types. We're going to jump into to rally or not to rally, and what are some of the pros and cons of joining rallies, especially if you're new to planning an offshore passage. You might want some help doing that. Weather routing is a very critical part of any sailing, whether it be a long or short-term sail. So that we're going to discuss provisioning, fuel planning, and water planning. Finding crew. We just added this morning. Thanks, Glenn, for putting that on your email to me. I mean, that's a tough one sometimes, and I just totally overlooked it when we did the original agenda. Watch schedules, night sailing, just general safety tips, and just a little blurb on kids and offshore sailing and offshore passage planning if you had kids on board. So let's go ahead and jump into, first of all, the different types of passages and just trying to put some terminology behind it. This actually came from an insurance company and their definition of coastal, nearshore, and offshore. So this is not arbitrary. I guess it could be arbitrary. It came from an insurance company. But basically, the big difference is when it comes to passage planning will certainly depend on what type of passages you're going to be doing. Coastal is defined as less than 50 nautical miles, nearshore less than 200 nautical miles, and offshore would be farther than 200 nautical miles offshore. I guess the question I would like to ask Glenn or Stephen and Sarah, I mean, do you anticipate or in your planning, have you done anything different in your just in general in planning, whether it be nearshore or offshore or coastal in your overall planning? I mean, what goes through your head when you think about what type of things you need to be doing based on how far offshore you're going to be? Glenn, we'll start with you. So you
sure, Mark. I mean, I think everything falls into place when you think about the distance and the time away from land or the nonstop element of it. And the rest of your agenda starts to, become more relevant, like watch schedules and planning for food and,
yeah,
you know, so many different things. So, I think that we think about it, you know, at the end of the day, it's a decision to go a macro schedule that we usually map out in advance, which is another topic of, you know, picking the right seasons and so forth, but maybe in the weather discussion.
Yeah. I think what I would say just in general is like when we sailed from the Philippines to Malaysia, that was a 7-8 day sail direct, but we were never more than 200 nautical miles offshore, but that didn't matter to me. What mattered to me most was how long am I going to be at sea? How do I feed the people on board? What's our watch schedule? So the offshore nearshore didn't really factor into it. It certainly makes a bigger difference when you think about doing a blue water passage, like crossing the Atlantic or the Pacific makes a big difference because of just the isolation of it. But that was just my experience on our trip down from the Philippines. Let's keep moving because we have a ton of stuff to cover. So the first question is that we talked about is to do a rally or not to do a rally. And Glenn, you've done some rallies before. What are your comments and thoughts about this, especially for those that might be listening that are newer to sailing and want to start doing some more offshore stuff?
Do one. That would be my advice, guys. We were contemplating, you know, extended world cruising and crossing the Med, maybe the Pacific. And I wanted to do one because of the preparation that was involved. The social part, the safety in numbers, you know, was kind of secondary, but it was really the preparation that was on our mind. And we chose the Caribbean 1500, which is a World Arc rally from Hampton, Virginia, down to the Caribbean as the one we did. And I'll tell you, the preparation that went into it and the checklists and the procedures that this organization wants you to create have been something that we invested in and have used for years since then. That was 2018.
Yeah.
The downside is, you go when they say to go, and there may be more boats involved than you want involved, but at the end of the day, they picked the weather window, and I think now looking back, I would pick my own weather window, and I wouldn't value the rally as much. But for the first year of cruising, it was absolutely a huge value add for us.
Yeah, I would add to that. We did the rally from the BBI up to Bermuda with the ARC. That was our first year of sailing as well. We had had family and all that kind of stuff and having to deal with all the planning, even though we'd sailed all the way up to the Caribbean from Argentina, that was just myself and one other guy. So we just had two of us total on board. It made a huge difference in just confidence. It made it easier for Sarah to know that, people actually inspected our boat to make sure we had all the right safety equipment on board before we were allowed to even leave as part of the rally. So it was good. We also did a rally here in Malaysia. By the way, after I did that rally, we didn't do any. I wasn't a huge fan. I don't like people telling me when to leave and tell me what weather when to do. It's probably I'm just stubborn. But I will say that the Sail Malaysia rally around Borneo was good, mainly because of security reasons. So in that scenario, they had Coast Guard, the Navy, as literally sailing with us to protect us from the Abu Sayyaf pirates in the Philippines. And so that was a needed thing. I would never do that sail around Borneo without having some sort of security, and that was a reason to do it. But that's good advice, Glenn. Thanks for that. I don't think, Stephen, have you guys done a rally yet? Or Barbara and Scott, are you guys thinking about doing a rally? What's your...
Not yet.
Not yet.
I found all the masses of boats that were in the Bahamas all talking about the weather and doing all that kind of thing really helped us sort of figure out how to do it. You heard a lot of different people getting their weather briefings from different places, and then you can make your own decision.
Yeah. Scott and Barbara, what are your thoughts? I mean, you guys are...
Yeah, we were actually crew on two fish a couple years ago for the Salty Dog coming out of Chesapeake down to
St. Martin.
And in that case, it actually got called off due to weather in the Caribbean. So it's very interesting, the dynamic of all the, you know, the pressure to go. And then Chris Barker and the guys running the rally basically saying you shouldn't go. So it was interesting. We may do a rally in the future, but I don't know. Like you said, I don't like being told when to leave or all that. So
I know Scott Gear doesn't. So you don't have to say anything, Scott. I saw your expression. That's not going to happen. Anyway, all right, we'll keep on moving. Thanks, Glenn, everybody, for your comments on rallies. So let's jump into weather and routing. You know, there are a number of different options. I'm going to just tick through these for those that are listening and cannot see this on the podcast, but we're going to talk about, you know, there's predict wind. That's now, I think, more or less the gold standard for a lot of people, myself included. But you also have the ability to use software on your desktop, like LuckGrib. I've used Maxi for a lot in the past. Then you can kind of jump into this next category of weather routing using Commander's Weather or other consultants. Chris Parker does that. And there are pros and cons to that. I've also used Chris Parker. I've used Commander's Weather before on passages. And then you have the free solution too. So Chris Parker does the free SSB nets, or at least he used to, down the Caribbean of Florida. Still does? Okay. So you have SSB if you have SSB, and you can also do self-routing. So we have many different options for weather routing and stuff underway. Let's just talk a little bit more about just some of the pros and cons of these. And I'm going to tick through these and feel free to jump in, Glenn or anybody else that has any comments on this. But I try to find a way to, if I was new to sailing and trying to figure out a passage planning, what would I want to use? I would say for sure, even though there's a cost to it and they have different levels, predict wind has been exceptional for me because it has polars as well, and I can go through and do a lot of pre-departure planning. So that's, and plus it has a very good offshore version that's low bandwidth for downloading over Iridium Go if you happen to have Iridium Go. You know, Maxi and more of the traditional Adrena, traditional desktop software items, it's a one-time purchase. I still have Maxi, I still use it, but I don't use it for weather routing anymore. PredictWind has overtaken that for me personally. Commander's Weather, I'll be curious to get some input from those of you that may have use a professional weather router. I have used them. I used them twice, once on the passage from New Zealand to Fiji, or sorry, from Fiji to New Zealand going south, because that's a really tricky one, or can be because of the lows that come through. It can be really rough. So I was worried a little bit, even though I'd sailed a lot. So I used them. And then, of course, SSB. So does anybody have any comments? Glenn, let me just jump on you, because I think you mentioned weather consultants. What's been your experience, and have you used them before?
Yeah, Mark, I decided when we first started doing the longer offshore passages that at least for the first couple years, I would hire a professional weather consultant, for each passage and have crew on board that had more offshore experience than me. We'll get to the crew part later. But the weather router thing, I think, let me look, we live in the weather as sailors, right? So, you know, whether it's predict wind or any of these other applications, I think every day, you know, you should be using it for, you know, near term weather situations. So I'm a big fan of predict wind as well. I've used a handful of others, but we've gravitated towards that. For the longer passages, we've, you know, gotten a custom weather plan from Chris Parker, because most of our sailing has been, you know, U.S. East Coast and Caribbean. Although he did help us on our crossing over to the Med. And that was a very accurate and not terribly expensive, you know, investment of maybe a couple hundred bucks per passage, which was well worth it.
So Scott and Barbara, you guys just finished getting from Argentina to Grenada. What was your experience with weather routing? What's your overall thoughts based on what you just finished doing?
So we use Predict Wind, but I also used Commander's weather. The when I did that passage on the in the Caribbean on that monohull, the professional captain uses Commander's, and he said he's used them for years, and so that was a pretty good recommendation for me. So I just signed up with Commander's, and then I got maybe three or four forecasts from them on the way up.
And they tracked us.
Pre-departure, sometime during each leg. And, you know, it's a bit expensive, but it was very, very informative.
Very detailed.
Very detailed, very informative. So I'll keep using them until I feel I'm competent in predict wind. Which I don't feel I'm competent in predict wind yet. So,
but I also think they were, I mean, not but like they were pretty accurate in that.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
You know, so they would send us every update they send us was a huge forecast, all these details. And then they would say, okay, we're tracking you. So we know where you are. So if we see something change, we'll send you a note or you tell us when you want a new one. So it was actually pretty good. They were always keeping an eye.
Yeah, would even say, you know, aim for this point on the map, because I told them when we were off the coast of Brazil and we couldn't find wind, right, where we were trying to get out of the ITCZ, and he's like, yeah, we were trying to go way north and we were bumping up on our insurance limit of 250 miles offshore, and he's like, yeah, you probably better just turn back west because there's no wind up there either. So it was pretty good. I'm a big fan, but I'm new at this.
Good. Well, I mean, that's a good point though. But I mean, if you're newer at doing a tougher passage, having somebody that's professionally overwatching you and giving you detailed updates, usually twice a day. So when I did use Commander's, it was twice a day, morning and evening. I would have updates from them, but they required me to send my Latin long, and when I did that, they would send me back a very detailed, you need to veer, you know, or you need to, they would give me actual coordinates and predict where I would be or where I should be to avoid a low coming through, as an example. I just saw a question. Yeah, I just saw a question come up from looks like Eric, and that's what forecast models, you know, if you use predict wind, you've got six now, I think, of different models: PWG, which is the predict wind GFS, predict wind ECMF version, and then of course the standard EC MWF GFS, and there's multiple other ones now. What's been your experience, Stephen and Sarah? I'll jump on you guys. It's harder to hear you, so if you guys can get a little closer to your mic, that would be great for those listening on the podcast. But what do you guys prefer? What have you seen as far as forecast models
are concerned? We look on Windy, and it does the compare, so we can kind of look at them all and get kind of a better idea of what might happen, as opposed to just looking at one and hoping that's right. I don't know that we really have found one to be particularly better. We would probably be more on the how not to chart, how not to do plan for weather.
Yeah.
Than to follow our advice.
Fair enough.
Still learning a lot.
Yeah. I think I guess what I would say in summary, we'll keep moving through this presentation, but just I would summarize it as this. If you use PredictWind, you can compare, you know, all the models against each other, especially when you're dealing with weather routing and the routing feature, and you can see and start to get a feel for, based on your location, what's been good. Chad, I know, said ECMWF in the comments. I tend to agree with him on some areas, but we have found that for us in the South Pacific, they all seem to be screwed up. So I don't know that I would lean on one. GFS has never been a very high on my list as far as it might be better in the U.S. and Caribbean, but it just hasn't been super, super great. But I mean, they all seem to be wrong, I guess, is what I've noticed. But anyway, okay, well, we'll just keep moving on to the next piece. We mentioned this briefly, so I won't spend too much time on this, but some of the key features of PredictWind that a lot of us like, and I just want to point this out in particular for those of you that own a boat, whether it be an Antares or different models, but PredictWind does have the polars for a lot of different boats. And of course, polars are the perfect sailing condition, the perfect boat weight, the perfect everything. And usually you need to handicap them by about 20%, has been my experience. Maybe even more if you want to be super conservative, because in a rough sea state, you know, your polars, unless you have sea state polars, are not going to be even remotely accurate based on the surging of the boat.
40%, Mark.
You do 40%. Wow. So I think the most aggressive I've gotten is I probably have done like 70%, but 40%. Wow. So you're down at 60% of actual polar on that. I loaded those polars up many years ago to predict when. Yeah, I did. It's many, many, many years ago. And sometimes I can get within like 15-20%, sometimes less, but that's conservative. But at least that gives you a lot better idea on your ETA, right?
It does.
Yeah. Okay. So we're going, the one more thing I do want to mention about PredictWind, if you haven't used it much, I mean, Sarah, Steven, or anybody else, but the departure planning, from my perspective, is very, very good, because it gives you a really good idea on what the weather would be like and what your passage would be like based on leaving, let's say, 2 or 3 days in the future. It's been very helpful for us to do that over the years.
Agreed.
Provisioning. Let's get into the big question. So now we've talked about, you know, weather, how do we get weather, but we need to also start thinking about, you know, how do we provision for a boat? So I would like to first jump in and ask Barbara and Scott, since you guys literally have landed after doing a long sail from Argentina up to the Caribbean, what were some of your tips for meal planning, heat and eat meals? I mean, Scott and Monica, you guys were on the chunk of that sail. So what are some of your tips and advice you would have on provisioning? Because it can be somewhat overwhelming.
If you can get Weaver to catch one of those big ass fish that he caught, ooh, that would be great.
Yeah. So my comment is, make sure you have ingredients for poke and ceviche on your boat, just in case you catch a big fish.
Go ahead. So what else? So what did you guys do for meal planning? I know that when you were in Argentina, I was down there and you guys were getting ready to leave and you were doing lots of meal prep. I mean, what did you learn? What was your key takeaway on your recent sail to Grenada?
Pre-cook as much as you can, because, you know, we spent, what, half of that 5,000 miles beating into the wind and current. So it's no fun cooking from scratch, right? So if you can eat. Simple breakfasts, lots of snacks. It's easier on everybody. That's my biggest takeaway.
Yeah.
And then when it does get nice and you can cook, then cook. But
another thing,
our galley was a flipping disaster by the time we got up here with all the cooking we did.
Yeah.
Underway and just, you know, it was good fun, but. That for me, if I had to do it over again, I'd have a lot more heat and eat meals.
Yep. Okay. So to add a couple things. One, I think for provisioning, a key thing was having a vacuum sealer I know that's not the food part of it, but
helping. No, but that's still provisioning. Yeah, food, sure.
Get food organized and get things organized. Yeah. And also make sure you know what your crew can and can't eat. I mean, we had on our second part of our trip, we had pescatarians on our boat, and we are huge carnivores. So there was a little bit of a, okay, how many meals can we make? What can we do? And, you know, food allergies and stuff. So it can be tricky if people don't eat like you eat.
So Barbara, you don't have the rule like we do on our boat. You get what you get and you don't throw a fit.
No. I mean, I guess if we really pushed it, we could have, but that would have been.
No, I'm joking. And then you have pissed off crew, and then it's a whole other problem, or unhappy crew.
It's the John Kretschmer theory of offshore dining. Feed them hungry and feed them in the dark.
Yeah.
So Glenn, what's been your experience? You've crossed oceans before with people on board. I mean, what are some of your what's your key advice to people about provisioning?
Well, I mean, what you guys have said is I agree, you know, as much prep in advance as you can do. Pam was a master. She's taking the night off tonight. Otherwise she would tell you, but she did a lot of prep, big believer in the vacuum seal thing as well.
Yeah.
Simple breakfast, lunch, you know, that people can get on their own. We always had somebody assigned to doing the dinners. I mean, just, you know, comfort food, you know, you can assume, you know, rough conditions and hopefully things aren't, but just something you can throw in a pot and heat up is preferable. The one memory I have is we were in the middle of the Atlantic for Thanksgiving one year, and we did do a Thanksgiving turkey meal well underway. That was a disaster in terms of the galley afterwards, but it was nice to do that.
That's a lot of work. That's impressive.
Yes, what?
That's impressive.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I would just agree with it, what everyone else said. I mean, just having the heat and eat meals are important to be able to have that. But also what we found was very effective is we got really detailed on our sail from Galapagos to French Polynesia. So that was almost 2.5, almost 3 weeks at sea. And we had, you know, we had 6 people on board, 4 adults and 2 kids. And so that's a lot of meal planning for 3 weeks continuous sailing. So we actually posted a menu, and we were pretty regimented about it. So people knew on what day what was being made and who was making it. And we had all the meal prep. We did Milanesa. We had a couple Argentinians on board, friends of ours from Argentina that we met. And it was great. And so we had the meals planned. We knew what we were going to get. We knew that for breakfast, it was feed yourself. Stuff was around to do that. Lunch was usually something pretty easy to put together. But we always had one hot meal that we asked people to at least try to join as an entire boat. So no one was sleeping, and we could at least join the meal together. So that seemed to keep the morale up. It was a lot of fun to do that. Well, thanks for your advice on provisioning, everybody. Let's continue to get into Glenn. This is you, and have you just jump into fuel and water planning and some of your experiences, because we have food, we also have fuel and water to be concerned with on a big passage.
So guys, I mean, look, you don't have to agree with the numbers or even the approach here, but I think it's important to, when you're doing a long offshore passage, to plan and budget fuel and budget water, you know, particularly if you end up having a problem with your water maker. Try to get a sense of how much you will use, what your range can be. You know, if you have 2 full 75-gallon fuel tanks plus, you know, a bunch of jerry cans, and you're going to count on having it, you know, running a generator periodically, you got to start thinking about, okay, well, what's my range? You know, what's my range, and what kind of safety buffer do I want to build in? And that on the left was our attempt to do that. And on the right, same thing relative to water. And I think we've tended to over-rotate on conservatism, you know, for both fuel and water. We've never run out. Came close on fuel once, but never run out.
That's good advice. I'll just add one more thing when it comes to water planning that we do religiously, and that's we always isolate the port or starboard water tank and we don't use it. We just keep it completely full, completely isolated. So if there was some sort of an accident, someone leaves water running, we had a leak somewhere, we don't drain all the water out, and we at least have a full tank of water to use in an emergency. So it's kind of like our backup plan. So we do run the water maker more when we're underway on a passage, just to keep the other tank somewhat topped up, because I'm really worried with kids on board, at least I was, or they're now going to be in university, but you know, about dealing with having enough drinking water on board. Sarah and Stephen, you guys with fuel planning and water planning, what did you guys do in your sail up from Argentina? Are you guys on mute, or maybe they can't hear me?
If you called us, we froze.
We were frozen.
Oh, you froze. Yeah, I just asked you what your experience was with fuel and water planning on your sailing.
I rely on the water maker as much as possible, but I like the idea of isolating the tank. Also having a lot of backup water jugs in the hold stashed is good, and encourage people to be pretty conservative with it. Taking a saltwater shower like my nephew and I did up on the foredeck with the salt water hose from the anchor locker, and then a fresh water rinse, that'll save a lot of water.
So, okay. Wow. I never thought of that. That's a good one.
Watching the stocks. So
it might be a good one. I don't know if I want salt water on me, but yeah, no. I like my water maker.
We drank a lot of Argentinian wine on the way up. That saved water.
Yeah. That's pretty good.
Oddly, we hardly drank at all on the way up, so.
I'm joking. We didn't have any alcohol while we were sailing.
Yes. Mark, lighting weird?
What's that?
Is our lighting very strange?
It's a little bit, but that's okay. Don't worry. It's no problem. So let's jump into watch schedules and some key considerations that you need to be thinking about when you're trying to establish watch schedules. It's not super complicated, and we're going to get some good examples, in particular from Scott and Barbara and what they did. What I thought was pretty unique, and we'll let people weigh in on that. But certainly you need to be thinking about, of course, the duration of the sail. You know, fatigue is an important and dangerous thing that can happen on a boat, especially if you have sick crew. We had one instance where a crew member, not on our boat, but on a buddy boat of ours, had a kidney stone. And they were shorthanded as it was. And so one person was down with in severe pain, and it created a lot of fatigue and stress on that boat with that type of a medical issue. And that can be an ad hoc thing that really screws up your watch schedules. You know, more than 4 hours can be tiring. I did some research on this just for this presentation, and the U.S. Navy done, of course, a lot of research on watch schedules. And of course, it depends on your rotation schedule. But if you have the ability to have four people on board, you know, they were very strongly in favor, and the crew was of a 3-on, 9-off schedule. So that was their preferred for the Navy to do that type of a rotation. Experience of crew is another big one. So, you know, we all have had different experiences with people on board, but inexperienced crew on a night watch schedule is nerve-wracking for the captain. Weather conditions can change very quickly. You can be in really snotty weather, and so that can also create some hiccups on your watch schedule. But let's just get into, I jumped this in here, finding crew. I should have put it in a different spot, but let me just jump down to watch schedules first. And I want to have Scott and Barbara walk through what you wanted to walk through that you sent me.
All right. So the first part of our trip, we did the four schedule, 3 hours on, 9 hours off. So, and then our next crew that we picked up for the second part of the trip wanted to try this different thing that they've done. And it's four people, but it's a 4-hour schedule. And your first hour and your last hour overlap with the person who's on schedule next or before. And so you only are by yourself for 2 hours in the middle. So it allows you to have a really detailed, long handover, really have discussions about things.
Make sale changes.
Make sale changes. So you have two people there for a whole hour. You know, set the fishing rods out, you know, bring it in. So it worked pretty well. Scott was more of a fan of it than I was, just because I didn't want to talk to someone for a whole hour, you know, at the beginning and end of my shift.
And you're the social one.
And I'm the social one. But I know Scott Gear was like, hell no, I'm not doing this.
Scott, no, you keep getting picked on.
Yeah, sorry. We already had this conversation, so I know he was.
But it worked out well.
It did work out well for our case, and it's just something I'd never heard of, and it was interesting.
The big thing that I don't like about the 3 and 9 is that you can clock around, so you don't have the same shift every day. And that, and personally for me, the clocking.
Yeah, 3 and 9. Yeah.
I do not like it at all.
Yeah.
So if I can have the same 4 hours, 3 hours, whatever it is, shifts.
Yeah.
I'm the same way.
I need to have the same routine. I don't like I don't like it changing as far as that goes. Yeah. No. Glenn, how about you?
I think, Mark, the study that you referenced, I remember they went into some detail about sleep schedule, sleep routine, and so forth. And I think to your point, sticking with the same routine for your biological rhythms, get into a routine. If you start tweaking it, it's harder. So I'm a big fan of sticking with the same. I like the overlap concept. It's a clever idea. We've never done it. We've done three on, six off, 3 on, 9 off. When it's just Pam, you know, we do just the two of us, and she'll stand watch until, you know, 1 in the morning while I sleep, and then I take over from there, and then in the day we just do our own thing. But that's no longer than 4 or 5 days doing that.
I think everybody's different, and that's the creativity that you're going to have to come up with the watch schedules. But obviously, having something that works that keeps people less fatigued is the most important. Did someone raise their hand and ask? Someone said, I would like Elizabeth and Michael's schedule. Yeah, so this is an example of what we run on our boat when we have our kids on board. So our kids are required to do a watch. And we wanted to keep things consistent so that we have, you know, every morning, 6 to 9, Sarah was on watch, you know, and we don't deviate from this. I mean, it is what it is, but I do have a 6 hour watch. So I was saying 4 hours, not more than 4 hours. I do midnight to 6 constantly. I love it. It doesn't bother me a bit. I don't get tired. And then I can sleep for 4 hours at 6 a.m. So it's one of those things where I think it really depends. You guys can be creative and find out what works for your crew, and in my case, my family, because usually it's just my family as crew. I jumped past it, but I want to talk about this one, finding crew. This is a big one. Some of you guys might use Tinder, probably not advisable, but I had to put that on there. Because some people I think probably have, but what are your experiences with finding crew? We all have our stories. I have one I definitely want to tell, but let's start with Glenn. Let's start with you.
I haven't used any of these. I haven't used any of these, Mark. I've been fortunate, you know, to have friends and fellow sailors and family members join. A couple of cases, you know, I took a guy from Spain to the Canaries, and he ended up getting off in Gibraltar because I thought he was crew, and he turned out to be a passenger. And that was a recommendation from a friend. So, you know, that was the one goof up, I would say. And otherwise, it's you know, I've been fortunate to have, you know,
friends,
good people.
You know, has anybody on the call that would like to volunteer their experience in using more of a, you know, social environment like Crew Finder? If those of you listening, it's Crew Finder. There's Spin Sheet. There's In the Bite. Which is probably more for offshore fishing. I put Tinder on here as a joke, so I don't want anybody to volunteer that one. But what's been your experience in using other services besides your own personal network on finding crew? Anybody have anything to share with the group? if not, I'll just share one experience. So I have been fortunate enough, and I think a lot of us are as Antares owners, we have a lot of friends in the community that we can reach out to. And I've had a good friend of mine for many years, Neil Sullivan, who owned Escapade. He and I sailed a lot together. We would swap out, and he crewed, and he loved to sail, and he would just fly wherever I was if I needed a crew and just show up. I thought one short. I said, you know what, Neil, we were going to sail from Fiji to New Zealand. And that is a notoriously difficult pass. It's one of the top two or three in the world to make just because the weather is so unpredictable at that time of year when you head south. So anyway, I wanted one more person. So I said, you know what, let me just go to Crew Finder. So I used Crew Finder. I got this guy, interviewed him. I thought I was good at interviewing. I hired tons of people, but I was pretty terrible at it, obviously, because the guy showed up to Fiji from California. And, you know, I got this feeling that maybe he didn't know as much as he told me he knew. And he was very insistent on wanting a certain bed on board. And I told him what his bed was. He's no, he was trying to negotiate a better bed. And I was like, you know, this is really pissing me off. And so net, I just got this feeling that this guy is going to be more of a hassle than not. And I just literally the next morning he spent one night on board. I went and bought him a ferry ticket to the mainland in Fiji and said, you're out of here. This is not going to work. You're going to be a liability for us. And I don't want that on my boat. And he flew back. I mean, he was pissed, but you know, I would rather have that situation than deal with a bigger problem on board with someone that was just high maintenance and didn't know what the hell he was doing. So that's kind of what it ended up being for me. Very bad experience. I'll leave it at that. So let's get on a more positive note, because that was really, really bad experience. Night sailing. So this is something that is one of my favorite things to do, is to sail at night. I love it. I've never seen a view like this. This is compliments of AI. But I just love sailing at night. What are what advice do you have, Barbara and Scott? You guys, as I mentioned, just got here. Night sailing. What do you guys do for safety? What are some of your routines for sailing at night?
Excuse me. A couple things. We had jack lines on the boat.
Yep.
Right. So we put jack lines on, and the rule was if you are going to go outside the cockpit at night, you need to wake somebody up. So you have the second person on board.
Yeah.
Luckily with this boat, as you guys know, you really don't ever have to leave the cockpit.
Yep.
Our rule is no peeing off the back, gentlemen. Yep. We actually on top of the stuff you have, actually have a little night vision camera, a little portable one.
Yeah.
That we find very handy. If we think we see something or whatever.
Yeah.
The other thing, I'm very concerned about my night vision and not turning lights on. But if you're making sail changes at night, you need to turn the lights on. You can't make sail changes in the dark, at least in my experience. Yeah. So we turn on the lights, make the sail changes. And I think from a safety standpoint, that's critical, right? Get those lights on, get those sails changed, whatever you need to do, get them back off and your night vision will come back. Go ahead.
I want to add two more things. One, we also put spotlights in front of our princess seat, dolphin seats, and that helps a lot of cases where
we have headlights on.
Headlights. And also in your comment on the chart plotter running the dual range, two plotters at 1 and 8, what helped us, especially just, and it could have been this, the route we were going, we had one on offshore mode and one on weather mode, because tracking where the schools were showed different things than when you were looking for boats. So that's how we did it. We kept one on weather and one on offshore.
Yeah. And then that's great.
Alter the distance. Yeah.
That's a very good tip. I don't have that option on the Furuno, but on the B&G you do. And so that's really good. Yeah, good tip. Stephen and Sarah, I mean, you guys are night sailing. I see all the lights on. How's it going? And any tips?
We're night sailing. The enclosure is up. We're doing 7.5 knots. We don't have our PFDs on, and we're staring at a bright white light. So are you asking what not to do?
Again, here we are. The model of what not to do.
Pretty
much. Is your radar on?
The radar's on. The PFDs are right behind us.
Good.
The wind is blowing 6 knots, so it's not.
It's calm. It's nice. Yeah. Good for you.
Yeah.
So this is probably not. Yeah.
All the safety considerations shared are pretty key to follow. I'm guessing most people on this call do them already, but you can always learn a few more things. I couldn't agree more about turn on the spreader lights, deck lights, so you can see what you're doing for sail changes.
Yeah.
I tried to change a sail last night, bringing the Genoa without using the winch, partly to see the winds again were very light. You kind of have to just use your electrics. Don't worry about people sleeping. They'll go back to sleep or they might not hear it. So don't try to be quiet for your sleeping crew because of sleep schedules. But
yeah. One thing for sure that I will say that there is a big distinction, at least in my neck of the woods where we are right now, as it relates to offshore versus coastal night sailing. So we're in Asia, and sailing around here at night is a whole different animal than offshore. There are tons of small fishing vessels. A lot of them don't have lights on. They're floating fishing nets. They're called FADs, fish attraction devices, that are bamboo hanging up in the water. And so it is a different, a lot of sailors will not sail in these waters at night, which is fine. It's their decision. I mean, we do, I'm not worried about it, but that's why I use the 1 nautical mile range on my radar, because I can pick up the FADs and the fishing boats, but it is a lot more stressful to sail coastal at night than it is offshore. I'd much rather be offshore than coastal sailing at night. It's a big difference. Anything to add, Glenn?
Mark, we had a question from Marshall asking if Scott would share a link to his night vision device.
Yes, he gave the thumbs up.
Yeah, well, yeah. I'll do it now.
Yeah.
Hey, Mark, you got one thing to add to that night thing. So I've seen people peeing off the back of the boat in the dark on the other side of the lifelines. I've seen people go forward without their PFD and they're not clipped in, you know, because it doesn't seem like a big deal. We've got on order these little ACR things. Barbara's looking at me like, yeah, you're talking about Mateus, right? Yes, I'm talking about Mateus. He's like 28 years old and invincible, you know, never gonna die. But we've got these little ACR things. It's an NF near field something or other. It's like you just put it on your wrist. And if somebody goes off the boat, it sounds an alarm. So like you've got a bunch of crew and you're saying, hey, everybody, please, please don't be stupid. Wear your PFD and stuff like that. And they may or may not do that. But you can probably get them to put something on their wrist. And if they fall out the back of the boat, alarm goes off and wakes everybody up. So we'll have that here in a couple of weeks. And we're going to test it on our run up and we'll report back.
Okay. Thanks, Scott. That sounds very interesting. Very good. I'm Mark, sure that they're, go ahead, Glenn.
Sorry. I think that's an awesome addition. Those things didn't exist when we were outfitting Mira. I learned one thing. We did a long passage with Karen and Jason Trout, some very early Antares owners. And Jason taught me before nightfall to do a walk and inspect the rig every night. Because he said, you know, if things pick up in the night and you've got problems, you don't know. And we just got in that habit before sunset, you know, just walk around, look up the rig, look at all your, you know, lines and stanchions and blocks and, you know, all the rig and just make sure that things are looking right.
Yeah, that's good advice. I had not thought of that. Okay. Anything else, Glenn? Sorry.
No.
Delay on my side. Okay. So on the pre-departure planning, you know, what do we do before we leave? Kind of goes back to this whole concept of offshore planning. You know, everybody has probably some sort of a review checklist. I don't necessarily want to go through every detail on here. But a couple things that were are very important that we do on our vessel. And those of you listening in, just we have on the screen a review checklist of, you know, ensuring that radios are working, the PLBs and EPIRBs are tested, the ditch bag is in good order, the tender and motor secured. I'll be curious to hear how people secure that for offshore passage making, you know, jack lines, et cetera, and a lot of safety stuff. But what we do always is we do two things. We do a mock fire drill on board before we leave. I want to make sure the kids know exactly what they're going to do, or whoever's on board, if they're in a cabin, how do they deal with a fire on board? And also, how do they deal with it with an MOB? So we used to do this religiously. I haven't in the last couple of years, but we would do real MOB drills with people before the day before, or the 2 days before, the week before departure. If I had crew on board that were doing the sail, we would do MOB drills, and we would chuck something overboard and have whoever's at the helm recover it. So that might be a little bit more, I don't know, rigid, but I just felt like doing the larger, you know, a week at sea passage, I was really concerned about losing somebody and not being able to have somebody recover them. Any other advice that people would have on pre-departure planning, that things that you may be doing or do that you would recommend, that's on the panel?
I was wondering how you deal with the sails when you have an MOB.
How do you deal with the sails if you have an MOB? Yeah. I mean, they'll teach you two main ways to do it, at least, you know, if either a figure eight, or what I do immediately is I put the boat into the wind. I mean, it just goes into the wind, and when I furl in my Genoa, that's the first thing I do. The main I'm not too worried about, but the Genoa I am. Yeah, I stop the boat immediately and put in my Genoa. That's how we do it on our boat. The main can stay up. I don't care about the main.
Yeah, stop the boat and turn the engines on.
Yes, right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, stop the boat, but make sure you don't get in the irons and you've got your engines going. Yeah.
Just put it in reverse and keep looking. Is that a...
What's that? Yeah. How about you, Glenn? What do you do on your...
For that situation or otherwise?
MOB.
I chuck Pam over the side to test it and make sure that we can pick her up.
Yeah.
And you know, fortunately that always works. I think the pull into the wind is the right way to go. You know, it immediately takes the drive away. That way you can furl whatever you need to furl. You can get the engines turned on. And, you know, if you have somebody else who can be a spotter, you try to assign somebody to be a spotter.
Yeah.
We fitted our PFDs with those MOB1 devices.
Yeah.
Which are personal locator beacons. They send a DSC alarm, and they also appear on your chart plotter.
Yeah.
So fortunately, I haven't had to use that in real life situation, but I do, to your point, I do check them. And in fact, just did both my EPIRB and my PLBs just a couple of days ago.
Yeah. Has anybody had an experience with anybody that you know that fell overboard? Any stories to tell? Not really. We were with a sailing family sailing in New Zealand, and they had 4 or 5 kids on board. They're all their kids, and they let their kids play around on deck. We were sailing north to Fiji, and they had a flogging sheet, and their little daughter, who was like, I don't know, 4 or 5 years old, maybe, was playing with the sheet that had gone slack. And then all of a sudden the wind caught and it went snap, and it tossed her overboard. And she didn't have a PFD on. So the mom saw this happen, and she screamed, and we were sailing together. They were not right next to us, but they're farther away. We saw them stop. We're like, what are they doing? And the mom jumped overboard she just bailed over to get with her daughter to hold her. And they went around and did a recovery. Fortunately, it wasn't rough seas. It was pretty calm. It was blowing like 10 knots. But again, that was an example of a kid falling overboard and the mom just bailing, jumping in the water, and then having 2 people overboard to pick them up. But I don't know. That was a tough one. But wear your PFDs, I guess, especially with kids. That was nuts.
Yeah.
So we're kind of getting close to the end here, which is good because it's almost 9 o'clock. But kids in offshore sailing, I just told a story about kids falling overboard. You know, I think what I would say to those of you that are thinking about sailing, doing offshore with kids, you know, the menu and doing fun things for the kids was really important. They liked having certain days for certain treats. So we had like sucker Saturdays. We had, every day was something unique for the kids to at least look forward to. So they would get up and say, hey, it's a day Saturday. It's sucker Saturday. That's great. And then they would play some games, listen to audiobooks. I mean, you know, I think the challenge is boredom sometimes with kids, but they're kids. And we found that giving them, you know, a movie to watch, which they were allowed to do 1 hour, 1.5 hours a day max of any sort of a video to watch, and then reading books, it was just great. So I think our kids now, even today, like to go offshore and to sail, because for them it's kind of, you know, no, at that point it was no homeschool. Now, of course, you know, that's not the issue, but they just really enjoyed it. And so that was a big treat for us to see them wanting to say, hey dad, when's our next sail? They couldn't wait to go because it was fun stuff for them to do. So it made a huge difference on the enjoyment for those guys. Let's just open it up now for just general Q&A for anybody on passage planning. What questions does anybody have on any topic? You can either ask a question in the meeting chat or just feel free to just chime in and ask away. Paper charts versus electronic charts for passage planning. I had them on board. I chucked them. But anybody else have any comments on paper versus electronic charts?
Used them for my first Atlantic passage just to kind of plot our location every day, and haven't since.
Yep. Anybody else?
I think if you keep a logbook and you write down your lat longs regularly, I think electronic is fine. If you lose your ability to have electronics, you want to know where you were. So I think if you've got to keep a paper set of logbook to properly use electronics,
or a backup
that's not
VPN.
Yeah, that's not affiliated with the boat itself.
Scott Gear, what are your thoughts on this?
When I sailed up to the Caribbean with Brent on Rome, I took a big tube that was full of paper charts with me and never opened it up. Because we just used, you know, we used chart plotter and we used our iPhones and used Brent's laptop and somebody's iPad. And, you know, you want to have backups, but you get to a point where, like, you've had to have so many things fail for you to not have any form of navigational chart at all. If you're at a paper chart, you're probably in big trouble. That said, you know, Monica and I did a lot of our sort of sail training in the San Juans in the Pacific Northwest, and we use paper charts all the time. It largely is a communications tool because we would talk to each other about where we're going and what we're going to see, and we're going to go around that corner and it's going to be shallow there and big current there. And it's kind of hard to do that when you're looking at your iPhone. Or even one of the larger chart plotters where you zoom in and then you zoom out. And sometimes it's really nice to just roll out a big piece of paper and put your finger on it. So, you know, we still use it for that. But I think more as a communications tool versus a navigational tool.
So will you have paper charts on board?
Yeah, we'll have a giant. We're even doing the chart storage underneath the TV that nobody does anymore.
I do have that on my boat, and I do have paper charts underneath there, a couple left that I like for the Caribbean that were just pretty, but we haven't really used them. Yeah,
you know, and we've heard about people you know, later discovering they never use their paper charts and they use it for Christmas wrapping paper, so maybe we'll do that.
Yeah,
speaking of that big TV in the salon, one of the things we like to do is pull the chart up on the iPad and then cast it to the TV. So if we're talking about planning a passage, or, you know, we've got guests or crew aboard, you know, just kind of throwing it up on the screen and then showing them, you know, where we're going.
That's a great idea. Actually, Brent was doing that with PredictWind when we'd have a crew meeting, and he'd put PredictWind up on the TV That was pretty handy. And yeah. Actually, since I mentioned that, I'll throw out one thing from earlier. We found that the predict wind, and you guys can correct me if you figured this out, but predict wind doesn't seem to be very good at oceanic currents. It's fine for tidal currents, but we had to use windy to understand, you know, we'd get into like 1 to 2 knot oceanic currents that didn't seem to be built into the predict wind model. So we were going to a sort of a secondary app for that information.
I haven't had that experience.
I'll tell you, I think they have it. It's built into the weather routing feature. I think they used to have it as an option where you could actually display, like Windy does, the, for example, the Gulf Stream.
Yeah.
And I think for whatever reason, they changed that. So you only get access to it as part of the weather routing.
So
if you do that, look for it there.
Okay. That was kind of my impression, was that it seemed like it was included in the in their calculations, but I couldn't figure out how to actually see the currents, right?
I think if you get the professional subscription, you can see them.
Okay. Okay, can you just send me your password so I can?
I used to be able to.
We can negotiate that.
Yeah.
I
used to be able to download them all the time on PredictWind, the currents. So I haven't used it in a while. So I it could be different. Glenn, to your point, you guys are on the water now with it. So I don't know.
Yeah, you know, I don't recall the level subscription that I have, but it's not a standalone feature. The only time I see it is in the weather routing.
Weather routing. Yeah. That's interesting. Anybody else have anything?
Yeah, go ahead. You can display it there.
Yeah. Anybody else have any other questions, comments, thoughts on passage planning? I mean, Stephen and Sarah, you guys seem to be like moving along still. Haven't hit anything yet, so it's all good.
Gulfstream is taking us along at 3.5 knots. Very happy.
Nice.
Oh, that's good. That's great. Is it warm or cold?
It's very warm out. The water is very warm. When the wind is blowing a nice brisk 6 knots, you really need the current to help.
Yeah, that's great. Well, you guys have a very good rest of your passage on the way up to North Carolina. Enjoy your, what's your ETA, by the way?
Friday evening.
Oh, Friday. So that's soon.
Friday evening to both. We'll probably anchor there and then go to Merritt the next day or Sunday.
Okay. Great.
Mark, where's sounds your good. Advisor?
Yeah, it looks good. Looks good, Stephen. Anybody else have any other comments? Otherwise, just thank you for joining this conversation on passage planning. We will have this on the podcast probably by tomorrow on the podcast. And I've had a lot of people, as I said, ask if we're going to have it on YouTube. We will put this on YouTube as well. So thank you, everybody. Have a good rest of the evening on your side, morning my side, and we'll talk to you soon.